this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with a cover story headline, Fight for Corporate Jets. As RDU focuses on commercial traffic, smaller airports brew recipe to attract business jets. And that's on the front page. The actual article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline, Jet Setting Around the Triangle. And this article is written by Lauren K. Onasorge. Past Raleigh-Durham International Airport sprawling Terminal 2, in full view of commercial jet takeoffs to Paris, London, and Seattle, traffic at the General Aviation Terminal is waning. Luxury corporate jets out of companies such as SAS Institute and United Therapeutics still call RDU's hangars home, but despite a waiting list full of aircraft with pilots hungry to park alongside them, activity among private flyers at RDU has decreased over the past decade. RDU reported nearly 43,000 operations in general aviation for the first 11 months of 2016. Compare that to the more than 54,000 it had seen during the same time period in 2006. And a massive airport revamp, one intended to add new gates, parking facilities, and replace an international runway, does little to accommodate demand for general aviation, an area economic developers have called a gem amenity in attracting new businesses to the state. It will take us some time to get to a point to meet that demand, says RDU Airport CEO Mike Landguth. I don't know if we'll meet all that demand. Landguth notes that kind of traffic makes up less than 2% of overall RDU revenue and says his team is investing in expanding its commercial flight portfolio, recently boosted by its Paris flight. We don't want to leave out general aviation. It's just going to take us a little while, he says. But airfields in places like Sanford and Smithfield are jumping in, working to lure corporate flyers and their tax dollars away from major airports such as RDU. There are several companies in the Triangle that have $30 million airplanes and could easily get in and out of Johnston County Regional Airport, notes Chris Johnson, Economic Development Director of Johnston County. If we were able to land one of those, you're talking about $500,000 to the tax rolls in Johnston County. They are scheduled to get help in the form of tens of millions in taxpayer funds, as dozens of aviation projects are included in the North Carolina Department of Transportation's latest 10-year draft budget. Airports focused on general aviation, from Johnston County Regional Airport to Franklin County's Triangle Executive Airport, are gearing up, plotting their own major revamps aimed at making their runways and hangars more attractive to corporate flyers. The stakes are high. As the airport's runways and terminals expand, so do the economic opportunities they present. General aviation is big business in North Carolina. According to NCDOT, overall general aviation contributes more than $2.7 billion in direct economic impact to the state. Its total economic impact is estimated to exceed $4 billion. General aviation supports more than 23,000 jobs across the state, contributing just under $122.6 million in state and local tax dollars. Harnett Regional Jetport alone accounts for more than $107 million in direct impact, topping the region. But concern exists about a small airport's ability to cater to the executives and companies. Moving away from RDU. A typical day for Ed Oleksii, chief pilot at Elite Aircraft Services, involves catering to a swanky executive, soaring through the skies to make a business meeting on time. Oleksii's company used to just operate out of RDU. Convenience, however, led his team to shift much of its focus to Raleigh Executive Jetport in nearby Lee County. Tucked into Sanford, the airport hosts about 130 planes, according to NCDOT. RDU is a great facility, but any sort of airport served by major airlines, those airlines become that airport's larger customer, he says. From a business standpoint, their policies, their procedures, their infrastructure, their overhead, it's all geared toward what the airlines need. His customers are pulling his firm to feeder airports, citing congestion and expenses at RDU, all reasons Duke University recently relocated its helicopter fleet to Johnston County Regional Airport. Raleigh Executive offered many of the same resources we had at Raleigh-Durham, Oleksii says. But we don't have to wait in line for takeoff at Sanford. We don't have to pay to park in a parking deck and then have someone shuttle you to a lobby somewhere. It's instantly accessible. At Raleigh Executive, about 63,000 flights take off and land on the runway annually. At RDU, flights in 2016 were expected to eclipse the 11 million passenger count, driven by commercial operations of carriers such as Delta, Southwest, American, and United. For the first 11 months of 2016, RDU reported a total of 175,420 overall operations, which would include all flights and aviation uses. Dan Danily, executive director of the Burlington-Alamance Regional Airport, hears it all the time. Their emphasis is on a different type of passenger traffic, he says of RDU. We non-commercial airports can just provide a different kind of service. Danielli says it's not about competition, it's about access. As the commercial airports grow and expand, that opens the doors for more of the corporate guys and the general aviation people to want to choose the local nearby airports, such as Burlington, he says. Challenges abound. There are drawbacks. Raleigh Executive, for example, doesn't offer high-speed internet at its hangars, a big deal for business travelers, Oleksii says. While Oleksii's company is working with Raleigh Executive on issues like that, they're very receptive, he says. It's one reason why some luxury travelers haven't hopped onto the feeder airport bandwagon. Danielli says larger commercial airports, fixed-based operators or chains, providing certain services that smaller budget companies at municipal airports just can't deliver. While he says Burlington's main terminal building offers competitive services, in some rural communities, quote, there's still a lot to be desired, unquote. I'm hoping more communities across the state come on board to help, he says. And there's a component of corporate flyers that will just never leave RDU, notes Bobby Walston, head of aviation at NCDOT. And it's because of amenities they've grown accustomed to, such as the rental car services offered at RDU's General Aviation Terminal. Many general aviation airports, Raleigh Executive included, do connect passengers to rental cars. Whatever they need when their jet comes in, RDU will take care of it, Walston says, adding that luxury corporate flyers are willing to pay more for RDU's hangar space. They take care of them from A to Z. Raleigh Executive Jetport Director Bob Hutes points out that many of RDU's braggable amenities, from restaurant offerings to retail, are a pain for general aviation passengers as its terminals and security checkpoints are located away from the general aviation hub. And, at least broadly, corporate flyers tend to favor convenience over amenities, says Brian Foley, an aerospace analyst with New Jersey-based AV Strategies. The private aircraft community, they don't want to go to big airports, Foley says, explaining that satellite airports give them what every executive needs, more time. It can be closer to the front door of their business location. That's good for both those airports and RDU, Landguth says. As municipal airports step up, RDU can concentrate on what we do best, he says, and that's recruit the next international flight. Rising demand. Not even the local airports can keep up with the general aviation demand RDU is letting slide. Danielli, whose airport has a bid out for 10-unit hangars, says he's always playing catch-up. Similar sentiment to how other general aviation airport directors feel. Raleigh was named the country's 16th fastest-growing metro area by the U.S. Census Bureau last year, with close to 1.3 million residents. The metro is the nation's 44th largest, moving ahead of Richmond, Virginia, and New Orleans in recent reports. If it were combined with the Durham-Chapel Hill metro, it would rank 37th, just behind the Nashville, Tennessee metro. And more companies have the triangle in its expansion crosshairs, companies with corporate jets. And we'd like to have more of them here, says Ken Starling, chairman of Johnston County Regional Airport. That airport, home to 116 aircraft and about 32,000 flights each year, is full to capacity with a 15 to 20 aircraft waiting list. 2 years after opening a $4 million terminal, it's plotting additional expansion with a $3.6 million cash infusion from the state. The capacity, created by a new T-hanger area and apron, however, is already accounted for on that waiting list, Starling says. General Aviation already contributes more than 23,000 jobs across the state and more than $120 million in economic contribution. Danielli says that increases with each expansion. Locally in Alamance County, our tax base is equivalent to 160 homes, he says of his restaurant. And airplanes don't need schools and water and sewers and things like that. The tax base isn't the only way these airports contribute. An economic driver. Norris Tolson, CEO of the Carolina Gateways Partnership, says airports are a huge economic development tool. Tolson says developers use airport proximity alongside a plant's access to the state's interstates to lure major companies to industrial sites in eastern North Carolina. At Triangle North Executive Airport in Lewisburg, its proximity to a nearby industrial park has already lured interest from at least one airplane parts manufacturer, for example. And developers also use the airports to help executives shop for sites. Tolson's team hosted transportation giant CSX in a helicopter, touring a site in Edgecombe County by air. It was that flight that clinched Rocky Mount for a giant $272 million intermodal terminal hub, Tolson says. Analyst Foley says more demand for general aviation could be coming. General aviation is still relatively flat compared to where it was at the start of the recession. It is picking up, especially in growing markets such as the Triangle. As the aircraft industry recovers, discretionary spending is just now starting to return. If portfolios are doing well and executives are feeling confident about the economy, that could be a plus for general aviation, he says. Of the state's 72 public airports, all but 10 focus on general aviation. Walston says the state also recognizes they are important to the pilot pipeline, a factor that trickles down to RDU. Pilots needed. Gary Broughton, Deputy Director of Wilmington International Airport and President of the North Carolina Airports Association, points out that general aviation includes flight instruction, something ever important as airports such as RDU increase their route count. It's very important that we focus on commercial service for our communities, but at the same time, there's a pilot shortage booming in this country, and they have to start somewhere, he says. It's already hard to maintain or retain these student pilots. And that's another gap smaller airports can help fill, Hutes says. He notes that Raleigh Executive is home to one of the largest flying clubs in the state, perhaps a more equitable option for a student wanting to hit the skies than traditional private instruction. You're typically going to find a flying club a much more reasonable cost option, he says, adding that retirements mean real opportunities for young people wanting to get into the aviation industry, as long as they can break through the financial barrier. It's one of the many reasons the state is pushing for more investment in general aviation, says recently departed North Carolina Secretary of Transportation Nick Tennyson. The potential impact of any community having a strong general aviation airport is something the governor recognized in his transportation vision, he says, referring to former governor Pat McCrory. Airport officials just hope the investment continues. We have 705 acres here, says Raleigh Executive Hutes. I don't know that there's a limitation on the number of airplanes we could have here. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. And we start with the main headline, Many Skip 13th Floor When Building Up. Some people may consider it a silly superstition, but in the world of high-rise real estate development, the decision of whether to include a 13th floor for a new tower building is very real. With this week having a Friday the 13th, Biz wondered how some Triangle developers approach the issue of a 13th floor. My policy always is to skip it, says Cary real estate developer Greg Sandruder, a partner in the development of the 17-story West at North Condo Building in downtown Raleigh. I'm not at all superstitious, but I'm thinking how my customer may react. It's one of those thousand decisions you make about how a project detail might impact your customer. In other words, don't give a potential buyer or renter a reason to say no or feel weird about a building. Hit the easy button, he advises. That said, Sandruder's partners in the development of the 22-story Sky House Raleigh apartment building kept floor 13 in the lineup. And it has leased up just fine, Sandruder says. Imagine that. The Hillsborough Street Holiday Inn, a Raleigh landmark, has no 13th floor. For Highwoods Properties, the default decision is to also skip floor 13 in elevator numbers and suite assignments. President and CEO Ed Frisch notes that most of the company's high-rise buildings in the Raleigh, Atlanta, Tampa, Florida, and Nashville, Tennessee, do not have a 13th floor, but two in Pittsburgh do. A goodly number of these are acquired buildings, so I can't promise the rationale behind each original developer's decision, but my money would be on pure superstition, he says. Andy Andrews, another Raleigh building developer who partnered with Highwoods in the development of the residential condos for the 33-story PNC Plaza in Raleigh, says his preference is to also skip floor 13. I never walked on a tennis court line either, says Andrews, a former professional tennis player. Party goes on, some irked by Switch. The revamped inaugural ball was a hit on the night of January 6th, at least for those who were able to pack into Marble's Kids Museum in downtown Raleigh. The Junior League of Raleigh, facing a rough winter storm, moved all events scheduled for January 7 up a day. That coincided with an event already planned for Marble's Kids Museum that included Governor Roy Cooper and the Council of State. It meant an exhausting day for Junior League volunteers who scrambled to pull it off. The league had expected a crowd of 3,300 for Saturday's events on the NC State University campus. Many people howled at the decision to change, taking to the league's Facebook page to voice their complaints. The league also did not allow refunds for those unable to come Friday. For those who did make it inside on a cold, wet night, they watched as Cooper spoke warmly to the crowd and promised to work across the aisle as governor. The Avett brothers arrived and played a pair of songs, and many local restaurants, including The Pit and Bita Manda, provided food. Junior League spokeswoman Elizabeth Hamner said about 1,750 people attended the last-minute soiree. Locals honored by MLK organization. Raleigh-based Students Against Violence Everywhere, which focuses on crime prevention, conflict management, and service projects, will receive the 2017 Coretta Scott King Angel Award from the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change. The award will be presented at the Atlanta Gala on January 14. Since its start nearly three decades ago, SAVE has involved more than 240,000 students through chapters across the U.S., Canada, and a number of other countries. SAVE is led by Executive Director Carlene Ray. Ray says it was truly an honor to be recognized for our efforts. Want to make a lot of cash? Go to Duke. Duke University is expensive, but a study by the U.S. Department of Education shows the price may be worth it after all. The department's college scoreboard ranks schools according to median student earnings 10 years after enrollment. By that measure, Duke's median salary of $76,700 leads the triangle and is among the best in the nation. UNC Chapel Hill is second in the area at $51,000, and NC State University is third at $47,600. Meredith College ranks fourth in the market at $46,700. And in case you were wondering, Harvard University graduates had a median salary of $95,500. Cary market is hot. It's widely known millennials are choosing to rent over buying homes. In fact, data from the U.S. Census Bureau shows home ownership rates among people ages 18 to 34 dropped nearly 10%. From 2006 to 2015, according to a report from Smart Asset. The situation is different in the triangle. Smart Asset ranks Cary as the number six city in the country where millennials are buying homes. Even though millennial home ownership dropped slightly from 2006, the Cary data shows home ownership of those younger than 35 was 35.5%. Nationally, that number was 32% in 2015 and 40% in 2006. And now we turn to the On Real Estate page written by Amanda Hoyle. Her first and main headline, $160 million project would tower over Hillsborough Street. The veil has been lifted on the first drawings and plans for a multi-tower development project that Raleigh-based Lundy Group and Hyde Street Holdings have been working on for close to 2 years at the corner of Hillsborough and Dawson Streets in downtown Raleigh. The partners, who in December closed on the acquisition of the last piece of land needed for the project, are calling it City Center. The estimated construction value is close to $160 million. Architectural renderings show a stair-stepped series of towers atop a multi-level parking deck that will have spaces enough for more than 1,000 vehicles. The spaces will also have about 40,000 square feet of street-level retail. At the center of the deck will be a 200-room hotel with meeting space and a 16,000-square-foot amenity deck overlooking the city. The developers have not yet identified a hotel partner or flag for that deal. On the Dawson Street side of the block, a 20-story office tower is proposed. On the Harrington Street side of the block, a 20-story multifamily tower is proposed. Surface parking lots add little to a vibrant urban core, said John Healy, principal at Hyde Street Holdings, in reference to the surface parking lot that currently covers most of the block. Our vision is to create a true mixed-use, live, give, work, play community on Hillsborough Street, the front door to Raleigh. The goal is to create a true sense of place. Briar Chapel leads fastest-growing list. A report analyzing growth of the largest master-planned communities across the U.S. has added a Chapel Hill neighborhood to the list in 2016, one of the only North Carolina communities to ever make the list. Newland Community's 1,600-acre Briar Chapel project was ranked number 40 on a list of the top 50 master-planned communities in 2016, according to a report by the John Burns Real Estate Consulting Firm. Builders at Briar Chapel sold 315 houses in 2016, a 50% increase over the year prior. Given that, it's little surprise that Briar Chapel also ranked at number one among the fastest-growing new home communities in all of the Triangle in 2016, based on a ranking by Metro Study. Here's the list of the top communities ranked by the number of new home starts in the trailing four quarters ended third quarter 2016 for Wake, Durham, Orange, Chatham, Johnston, Granville, and Franklin counties. Number 1, Briar Chapel, Chapel Hill, annual starts 239. Number 2, Carolina Arbors, Durham, 238 annual starts. Bella Casa, Apex, 229. 12 Oaks, Holly Springs, 178. Flowers Plantation, Clayton, 165. And finally, number 6, Wood Creek, Holly Springs, annual starts, 164. Developer hopes to lure Alamo Draft House to East Raleigh. Raleigh real estate developer John Holmes has filed redevelopment plans in Raleigh to convert part of an old New Bern Avenue shopping center into what could become one of the city's next hotspots for entertainment. Alamo Draft House Cinema is identified in Holmes' plan as the targeted anchor tenant for a new building at the Longview Shopping Center, a property owned by Holmes' family at the corner of New Bern Avenue and King Charles Road in East Raleigh. Holmes says no deal has been signed yet. If approved, it could be the first location in North Carolina for Alamo Draft House, the Austin, Texas-based offbeat movie theater and restaurant concept with 25 locations across the country. Location of newsroom sank N&O deal. If a group of Raleigh real estate developers had been able to move forward with their plans to redevelop the downtown Raleigh city block occupied by the News and Observer, it would have been huge. A hotel, possibly two hotels, offices, apartments, retail shops, and a park were all part of the dream that a group called itself Above the Fold LLC wanted to build on the 3-acre site. A deal, however, was contingent on creating a suitable environment that would keep the newspaper company's staff nearby, and Above the Fold partner Joe Whitehouse says that just couldn't make the deal work. The original plan was to renovate the newspaper's press building into office space and build a new structure on top. That would give the project the elevation it needed to justify the property's $20.2 million price tag. When we realized that wouldn't work, we looked at a lot of options, Whitehouse says, even putting in an offer to buy the nearby professional building to relocate the newspaper. Still, he says, we couldn't come to terms on a lease arrangement that was mutually beneficial for both of us. Whitehouse says there were no hard feelings left on the table on either side of the deal and complimented N&O publisher Sarah Glines for her efforts to reach a compromise. Sources say the newspaper is in talks again with another developer group interested in buying the site. Whitehouse says he has not been contacted by the potential future buyer of the site, but says whoever it is will play an important role in the future of downtown. It's a big block, a big site, and you can do a lot with it, he says. We'd love to get another run at it. Three longtime stores closing at Cameron Village. It's the end of an era for three longtime boutique retailers at Raleigh's Cameron Village Shopping Center. The shop owners of both Accipiter Gallery and The Party Shop will retire and close their shops for good. Pendleton Woolen Mills also will close in January. Lynn Worth, Senior Vice President of Retail Leasing and Property Management for York Properties, says the center already has prospective tenants for each of the spaces, but she declined to disclose details. The Accipiter Gallery had been at Cameron Village for 25 years. Owners Sandy and Pat Friedman sold specialized lighting fixtures, but the shop also carried an array of glass, wood, metal, ceramic, and fine craft items. Worth says the couple plans to retire, and the last day was January 10. The Party Shop has supplied party hats, balloons, and other supplies at Cameron Village since the 1960s. Cora Smith took over the shop in 1980 and plans to retire by the end of January. Pendleton had been in two locations at Cameron Village at different times over 15 years, Worth says. Perimeter Park in Morrisville could become new home of Inc. Research. Real estate sources say the new owners and developers of the Perimeter Park Corporate Center in Morrisville are close to signing a deal with Raleigh-based Inc. Research to kick off construction of the new $50 million Perimeter 5 office building this year. Inc. Research in December announced its plans to expand and relocate its Raleigh headquarters to Morrisville, plus an addition of 550 new jobs, but company executives at the time didn't disclose further details about where it would be moving. Sources say the company is close to signing a deal to anchor a newly proposed six-story Perimeter 5 office building on Carrington Mill Boulevard in Morrisville, but that no official lease contract has been finalized. With an advertised rate of $26.95 per square foot for office space at most other Perimeter Park office buildings, a lease deal of that size could be worth close to $5.8 million per year. And finally, in the section called He Said It, the quote, "We're the biggest in what we do in the world, but we don't stay that way by standing still." And that's from Dean Debnam, CEO of Workplace Options, on his company's plans to hire about 100 more people at its Raleigh headquarters by end of summer 2017. Nearly all of the jobs will be for work-life consultants, clinicians, and psychologists to support a new contract that supports a customer's employee assistance programs. And now we turn to the, also in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the On Tech and Transportation page written by Lauren Onasorge. The main headline, North Carolina setting transportation goals for the next decade. With the release of the state's 2018 to 2027 plan this month, the state has its transportation priorities outlined for a decade. The North Carolina Department of Transportation is soliciting public comment and is awaiting formal board approval in June, but it does mark a significant milestone in a major statewide undertaking, says Van Argabright, manager of the State Transportation Improvement Program and Feasibility Studies Unit for NCDOT. To come up with potential projects, internal NCDOT teams submit proposals, as do external players from metropolitan planning organizations, such as the Capital Area Metropolitan Planning Organization, which serves the Triangle, and rural planning organizations, such as the Triangle Area Rural Planning Organization, which serves Chatham, Lee, Moore, and Orange counties. Other projects can carry over. You take the carryover and you add new submissions and you come up with a database, he explains. From there, it goes to what it's called SPOT, Strategic Prioritization Office for Transportation. There, NCDOT officials perform an analysis that takes into account a project's scope, granting each proposal a technical score. Undertakings of statewide importance, such as the CSX Intermodal Project coming to Rocky Mount, or major interstate improvements, are eligible for statewide funding. Under the statewide tier, they're prioritized in May. What doesn't receive funding cascades into a regional tier. That tier is revealed in June and includes local input from those outside planning organizations. Projects that don't make that cut, as well as hyper-local proposals, are included in what's called the division tier. Those priorities are released in December. In January, all the project priorities are compiled in a massive draft list, one that fully outlines the state's transportation priorities for the next decade. The statewide tier has a $7.8 billion 10-year budget. Regional projects are capped at a total of $5.8 billion for the decade, as are division tier projects. Raleigh man sues Snapchat, says company misleading investors. A serial entrepreneur in Raleigh is suing California social media firm Snapchat, accusing the company of misleading investors to inflate its valuation. Anthony Pompliano filed the lawsuit January 4 in Los Angeles County Superior Court. In the suit, Pompliano alleges that a group of Snapchat veterans have been making false claims to investors in advance of a planned initial public offering. Snapchat will not let anything stand in its way of an IPO, including its obligations to represent material facts accurately, the suit reads. According to the complaint, Pompliano worked for Snapchat for about 3 weeks before being terminated. He claims that his refusal to participate in said misrepresentations led to his termination. Mary Ritty, a spokeswoman for Snapchat parent company, Snap Incorporated, said in a statement, "We reviewed the complaint. It has no merit. It is totally made up by a disgruntled former employee." Pompliano says he was lured to Snapchat from Facebook to run its new user growth and engagement team, but he alleges in the complaint that the real reason for his hire was so Snapchat could obtain proprietary information on Facebook, data Pompliano wouldn't provide, citing a non-solicitation agreement. He goes on to accuse Snapchat of seeking to, quote, destroy his career and reputation by waging a smear campaign, unquote, against Pompliano even after he was terminated. In the suit, Pompliano is asking for damages, both for lost wages and harm to his professional reputation. He is also asking for punitive damages and an injunction that would prohibit Snapchat, quote, from continuing to make false representations, unquote, about his departure. UNC launches effort to give startups some help. UNC Chapel Hill has a new initiative aimed at closing the early funding gap for startups. It's called the Carolina Angel Network and comes on the heels of the seed-targeted Hatteras Venture Partners managed Carolina Research Venture Fund, which kicked off a little more than a year ago. For a number of years, we have felt like we have great technologies, great ideas, great discoveries coming out of UNC, says Randy Meyer, the professor tapped to manage the network. The next step in the process is increasing access to capital. While the Carolina Research Venture Fund is for early ideas that, quote, maybe don't have a product yet, but they have a discovery, unquote, the Angel Network is for new companies starting to get traction in the form of customers. The next stage up is early stage money or funding and advice and help, he says. Cash pours in for local firms. 10 Triangle companies raised more than $10 million in a single round in 2016, according to documents filed with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission that detail entrepreneurial funding in the calendar year. The pharmaceutical industry dominated the funders, with Chapel Hill-based Bamboo Therapeutics, later acquired by Pfizer, raising nearly $50 million in a new round of financing in February, followed by Research Triangle Park-based G1 Therapeutics, with nearly $47 million. That increased to $50 million in amended filings. Among technology firms, Raleigh's Pendo led the pack with a December round that totaled nearly $20 million. But not all startups seeking funding in 2016 were in those two categories. For example, Organic Transit, a Durham developer of solar-powered hybrid vehicles, raised more than $2.5 million in a single round in April. And in a section called They Said It, overheard at the North Carolina Economic Forecast Forum, January 4 in Durham. And this first quote is from Roy Cooper, governor of North Carolina. "I promise you that as governor of this state, I will be an aggressive recruiter of good-paying jobs, because what I want for our people is for them to be healthy, better educated, and I want to put more money into the pockets of everyday working people so that they can have the opportunity to live a more abundant and purposeful life." The next quote, The Fed has been in a box for about 5 years over what to do with interest rates, and, of course, they increased them in December because there were no more months left in 2016. That's from Harry Davis, North Carolina Bankers Association economist. And the last one is from Vince Dealey, CEO of FNB Corporation. We were able to gain market share in Pittsburgh with PNC located across the river from us. It speaks volumes not about me, but about the people we have in the field. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Life Sciences, written by Jennifer Henderson. The main headline, NCSU leader discusses future. Leslie Bonney III, who most recently served as Vice President of International Community and Economic Engagement for the University of North Carolina System, is now Director of the Institute for Emerging Issues at NC State University. Bonney succeeds Interim Director Richard Mahoney, Director of the School of Public and International Affairs at NCSU. You started January 3. What have been the tasks you've been most excited to start? The first week has been understanding where my office is, how to get access to it, administrative sort of things. I visited recently with one of our investors who has been investing in the long term in leadership and got to hear what they valued about the Institute and what they might like to do with us going forward. That was a great opportunity. And I've been getting to know the staff. The next couple of months, I think, honestly, is going to be drinking out of a fire hose. We've got a forum in 30 days. That's our biggest event of the year. And that will be a great opportunity for us to really begin putting the issue we're going to be focusing on in the future, early childhood education, on the table in a very public way. What are some of the most important initiatives you plan to take on in your new role? The Institute is always working on several things at once. Last year, we spent a lot of time calling attention to the consequences of automation for employment in North Carolina's long-term employment future, so we're continuing to work on that, a focus we call future work. How does North Carolina change its education systems? How does North Carolina think about employment differently at a time when the churn in jobs is increasing so much? And one of the estimates is that by 2030, as many as 30% of current jobs will no longer exist. Maybe that puts a different burden on higher education than we've had in the past. It's going to force us to rethink how we restructure ourselves and our programs, probably offering more things at nights and on weekends and online and blended, so that's a huge piece of work that will continue. The piece of work that we're launching this year is focused on early childhood education. We call it Kidonomics, and it's trying to make the economic case for investment, either public or private, in quality early childhood education. The issue beyond that, I think, is probably going to be something related to rural and urban differences in North Carolina. What potential opportunities and challenges do you expect right after an election year? Anytime you come in after an election year, a lot of people have just run on a set of issues. Very few people ran on early childhood education. In terms of public policy, you don't have a whole lot of people who, during the election campaign, staked themselves out on this issue. On the other hand, you've got a new legislature that's just come in and they've got 2 years to work on big issues. We know they're going to be talking about public education. The question is, what's the span of public education that they're talking about? What about joining NCSU was most attractive to you? We've got this three-part mission: teaching, research, public service. And at NC State, public service is fully one-third of what it does. To me, the chance to be in a place that has public service ingrained in its DNA and says as part of its mission, we are going to take what we learn, what we know, and translate it into solving real problems, that's a place I want to be. When you have spare time outside of the office, what is your favorite thing to do? Play tennis. I don't play as much tennis as I would like to, but it's just a fascinating game for me. It helps me think better about other things. GenCentric CEO says headcount will double in 2017. Following a new collaboration with Bristol-Myers Squibb and a sizable equity investment by the New York-based pharmaceutical giant GeneCentric, expects its headcount to double in 2017, according to CEO Dr. Myla Leigh Goldman. The new collaboration will focus on GeneCentric's cancer subtype platform. BMS, along with several other investors, has also made a $6.1 million equity investment in GeneCentric. GeneCentric has been developing its CSP for several years now, and this platform allows us to use genomic testing to classify tumors in a way that really wasn't available previously, says Leigh Goldman. The company has been working on how using our subtypes can be potentially useful for patients being considered for receiving immunotherapy, such as the type that BMS has. Essentially, GeneCentric's work can aid in finding biomarkers that may select responder patients, she says. Adding the collaboration with BMS will see GeneCentric more deeply explore our system for their drug, Opdivo. As a result, Durham-based GeneCentric will bulk up in the triangle. We'll be expanding both our bioinformatics capabilities as well as building a research lab in Research Triangle Park, says Leigh Goldman. We'll be hiring in North Carolina for both purposes. With 5 employees currently, she says she expects 10 or more by the end of next year. Duke spin out to spend $25 million for Irish plant. Duke University spin out, Aerie Pharmaceuticals, will spend $25 million for a manufacturing plant in Ireland. The company said January 9 it has a lease agreement for its first manufacturing plant for product candidates Ropressa and Rocklidin. In December, Aerie said its new drug application filing for Ropressa, which treats glaucoma, had been delayed after its manufacturing vendor, based in Florida, wasn't ready for the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's pre-approval inspection. As we prepare for commercialization, it is increasingly important that we ensure greater independence regarding our finished product sourcing while also meaningfully reducing our future product cost, said Vincent Anito, Jr., Aerie CEO and Chairman. Italian firm puts more cash into Transcenterix. Italy's SOFAR SPA has upped its equity investment in Transcenterix to $5.2 million. This follows Transcenterix's acquisition of the Senhance surgical robot from SOFAR in 2015 and comes as an amendment to the purchase agreement, Transcenterix said. In place of receiving $10 million in cash alone, SOFAR invested in more than 3.7 million shares of Transcenterix's common stock. Chimerix reports progress on key drug. Durham-based Chimerix is continuing to progress a new intravenous formulation of brincidofovir after halting 2 trials for the DNA virus drug early last year and cutting 20% of its workforce. An ongoing Phase 1 study for the new formulation of brincidofovir achieved favorable tolerability and concentrations, the company said. These preliminary results build on our preclinical studies, which showed that brincidofovir was associated with fewer GI side effects, said Dr. Michelle Berry, CEO of Chimerix. Berry announced the company's trial plans for the new IV formulation of brincidofovir at the time of the company's cuts last year. In its third quarter results for 2016, Chimerix reported $288.3 million of capital to fund operations as of September 30th. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to A Better World, the page written by Todd Cohen, who is also the publisher of Philanthropy North Carolina. And we will read his column, is the only thing on the Better World page today, the headline, Carey Center Connects Volunteers with Those in Need. Every week, volunteers for the Center for Volunteer Caregiving in Carey drive seniors and adults with disabilities in Wake County to doctors, grocery stores, and pharmacies, and to government agencies to enroll in programs like Social Security. Volunteers who use their own vehicles and are selected by the center to participate after it screens and assesses them can use an online calendar to choose assignments. The center spent the last year developing the calendar using Volunteers for Salesforce, a software system for customer relationship management, or CRM, that it purchased with $30,000 from a grant it received from GlaxoSmithKline in 2013. The calendar is part of a larger effort to build long-term relationships with volunteers, companies, and funders to serve seniors in Wake County, home to an estimated 70,000 individuals aged 65 and older. By 2030, that population is expected to pass 200,000. The center was launched in 1992 by 12 churches in Cary and Raleigh, with $25,000 from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation in New Jersey as part of its national effort to help faith congregations create formal volunteer programs to serve seniors and adults with disabilities. Previously, congregations have provided those programs on an informal basis. A key goal was for the new programs to use formal screening, background checks, and training for volunteers. Operating with an annual budget of $425,000, the center employs 6 people full-time and 1 part-time, counts on 350 active volunteers, and serves nearly 800 individuals a year. In addition to transportation, the center provides volunteer relief and seminars for caregivers, as well as information and referrals, mainly to home health agencies that can assign substitutes for caregivers who need time off. In October, with a $25,000 grant from a family fund at Triangle Community Foundation, the center launched a pilot program that provides relief once a month for up to 12 caregivers who support individuals with dementia. Those individuals spend 3.5 hours at Genesis United Methodist Church in Cary. Then, through a collaboration between the center and the 5 Rotary Clubs in Cary, the individuals spend another 2 hours for dinner and entertainment at the Memory Cafe, a program at the town senior center. With rising demand for its services, the center is working to increase the number of its active volunteers to 500 from 350. To help do that, it has posted on its website a video produced by Blue Forest Studios in Raleigh in its second pro bono effort. Lynn Templeton, executive director of the center, says effective support for caregivers depends on cultivating long-term relationships. This year, for example, the center is getting $15,000 from Raleigh insurer Genworth, which for the past 15 years has provided it with annual grants ranging from $5,000 to $25,000. George Reichart, chief information officer of Genworth and a member of the center's board, led the effort to develop the online volunteer calendar. The 14-member board also includes executives from ESI, Quintiles IMS, John Deere, and WakeMed, as well as local attorneys. When we get to know companies, Templeton says, I try to start by involving them as volunteers, then try to get invited to apply through their grant process, then try to leverage excellent board members. Long-term relationships also are critical for effective volunteering, she says. We need volunteers who can invest in a relationship that is going to help alleviate loneliness and depression on the part of seniors and adults with disabilities, she said. There's something to be gained on both sides. And now, in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page. And here we start with the editor's notebook written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor of Triangle Business Journal. The headline on his Viewpoint column, Will Millennials Ever Have Economic Power? In the past few months, new data has started to emerge about the economic power of millennials that may drastically change the way businesses see and adjust to the country's next generation of workers. Citing analysis of data from the U.S. Census Bureau, online research firm Smart Asset concluded millennials, born between 1980 and 2000, are buying homes at a far lower rate than previous generations. In 2015, the home ownership rate for adults under the age of 35 was 32%. In 2005, it was about 43%. So why is this happening? Is it because millennials are not interested in living in detached homes because they prefer an urban environment with 360-degree access to all the necessities of life and walking distance? Perhaps, but there is a bigger and more ominous picture to this. Millennials' economic power. Using data from the Minnesota Population Center's 2014 American Community Survey, Business Insider concluded the median total personal income for employed millennials is far lower than the average population living in a given state. The median income ranged from $18,000 in Montana to a high of $43,000 in the District of Columbia, Business Insider editors concluded. For North Carolina, ACS data shows median income for millennials to be $20,000. In comparison, median personal income for all employees in the state was $31,900. Those numbers may seem low, partly because the youngest millennials may only be working part-time. But the overall thesis is right on the money. Millennials are struggling with their buying power. A Pew Research Center study last year concluded that for the first time in the modern era, living with parents edged out other living arrangements for 18 to 34-year-olds in the U.S. More than 32% of that age group lives with their parents, followed by married or cohabitating, 31.6%. About 22% had other living arrangements, such as living with grandparents, aunt, uncle, sibling, college dorm, or even a correctional facility, according to Pew. This is a lot of data for businesses who have catered their operational strategy in the past few years to millennials and getting them to buy their products and services. The only note of caution to these numbers I see is its time frame. Most of the data comes from 2014 to 2015. The jobs market has grown robustly in the past couple of years, and wages have begun to show some northward movement, finally. But I doubt it is up enough to trigger a sea change in buying power and broader economic viability. And that is troubling. And the other Viewpoint article is written by James H. Johnson, who is a professor of strategy and entrepreneurship at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School. The headline on his Viewpoint column, America's Greatness Lies with Its Entrepreneurs. A vowing to make America great again, President-elect Donald Trump's ascent to the nation's highest office has re-energized hate groups who denounce our growing multiculturalism. The Southern Poverty Law Center collected reports on 701 hateful incidents of intimidation, harassment, and violence against immigrants, Muslims, women, gays, and native-born people of color in the 8 days following the election. In one community, property was defaced with swastikas and Make America White Again written. Few would dispute the important role entrepreneurs play in making America great. Small businesses, according to Forbes, account for over 50% of total U.S. GDP and 75% of the net new jobs in the U.S., and studies reveal a high proportion of net job creation is attributable to startup ventures that are less than 5 years old. If a society's true grit is manifested in times of crisis, sources of our greatness can be found by assessing the levels and sources of entrepreneurial activity during and right after the Great Recession, the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression. Changes in entrepreneurial activity are found in data from the U.S. Census Bureau's Survey of Business Owners, SBO, conducted in 2007 and 2012. The SBO covers non-farm businesses with receipts of $1,000 or more and provides information on gender, race, ethnicity, and veteran status. What does the data reveal about the sources of entrepreneurialism in North Carolina? An internationally recognized hub of creativity and innovation and home of the Research Triangle Park and world-renowned research universities that attract diverse talent from all over the world? In 2012, North Carolina was home to 805,985 small businesses, 7,194 or 1% more than in 2007. Sales and receipts totaled $874 billion in 2012, 3.6% or $29 billion, higher than the $818 billion small businesses generated in 2007. Regarding the sources of our greatness, these aggregate statistics mask two significant shifts in our small business activity. First, minority-owned firms grew by 40%, an absolute increase of 52,531, while white-owned firms declined by 25,396, or 4%, between 2007 and 2012. Sharp increases in black and Hispanic-owned firms, 28,314 and 13,749 respectively, combined with modest absolute increases in Asian and some other race-owned firms, 7,464 and 4,124 respectively, were responsible for this minority enterprise growth. Among Asians, firm growth was concentrated among Vietnamese, 2,729, Chinese, 1,697, Koreans, 1,056, and Asian Indians, 904. And among Hispanics, it was concentrated among Mexicans, 4,657, and Puerto Ricans, 2,610. Sales and receipts also grew more rapidly for minority-owned, 46%, than white-owned, 25% firms. Most notable was the increase in sales and receipts for Asian-owned enterprises, 71% for all firms, 75% for firms with paid employees, and 42% for firms without paid employees, compared to white-owned firms with 25%, 28%, and 2%, respectively. Second, female-owned firms grew much faster than male-owned enterprises, 63,000 or 28% versus 19,000 or 4%. Partly as a function of this rapid firm growth, driven principally by white and black women, sales and receipts increased by 27%, slightly lower than male-owned firms, 32%. By many statistical indicators, the Great Recession wreaked havoc on the state and national economies, and matters would have been much worse if not for the numerical growth of minority and female-owned firms and their increased sales and receipts between 2007 and 2012. Looking ahead, it behooves us all, including Trump, to recognize that our diversity, notably in terms of entrepreneurial activity, is what makes America great. Rejecting our diversity is the wrong path to take if we want the U.S. to remain globally competitive. And with our remaining time, we'll look quickly at the People on the Move page, where the spotlight is on Jeff Lanter, president of Trailblazer Studios. Armed with a degree in communications and film video, Jeff Lanter has parlayed that knowledge into a long career in the industry. Now he has taken the next step in that 25-plus year professional journey, being named president of Trailblazer Studios in Raleigh. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? We get to meet and work with some amazingly creative people and get to experience some very unique worlds. And actually, we're going to have to stop right there, as we've run out of time in this episode of the Triangle Business Journal. But be sure to tune in next week at the same time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you.